I don't know if that's on brand for us to take things seriously. I think it's more of a thing that we just kind of like riff. I do get sad when Peaches isn't here to steal the intro, because then I have to do it and lull you into a false sense of security by thinking that I'm talking to you and I'm really not. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. It's the One's Ready podcast. You're in the team room. It's Trent. It's me. It's Pop Seeds. It's Aaron Loves America. How are you doing? Hello, Trent. What's up?
Can I put something out there? The whole Papa Seeks thing was not, it's not ops initials or anything stupid. All right. That's what some of my students called me sarcastically.
Yeah.
You know, way back. And so I thought it was funny to make that my name on Instagram. It's not, there's no operator type thing that goes along with that.
Why would you ever say, I would just imply that it was tied to something operational. And then when people ask me about it, I'd be like, oh man, you know, if you know, you know, but if you don't know, that's kind of why you gotta ask.
Because my whole shtick is I never did anything. So I don't know anything you don't know. Secrets are stupid. I don't know.
Mine is that I'm a piece of shit and I'm not worth anything. And that's why I'm here on the podcast.
Don't say that. Shtick.
Yeah. I know my therapist hates when I catastrophize. She does not like that. I bring a very depressed, anxious, and suicidal vibe to therapy that my therapist really does not vibe with. Those are all jokes, everybody. You had a great idea last night, Trent. You were like, I want to write a love letter to Air Force Special Warfare. Why did you want to do this? Why did you want to write a love letter to Air Force Special Warfare?
So, look, I like what we've been doing lately, where we've been, taking things on a little more seriously and giving suggestions to the community and the Air Force at large about things that we think they could do better, right? But I never want to lose sight of the fact that for 20 years, I had a fantastic time, right? Like, I think we've been talking about, like, oh, how to fix this and make it better. But I wouldn't have spent 20 years in the Air Force if it wasn't amazing. And I think the foundation of this podcast, the reason we said yes when approached to do this, is because, like, yes, we could do some good, but also I want to give back to this community that's done so much for me and provided me with, like, some really good times. And some of these we can't talk about because, statute of limitations. but a lot of them I think we can.
I think we can too. And it was great. As soon as you said it, as soon as you're like, I want to write a love letter, like, man, I love being able to be, you know, transparent and, you know, be a little bit critical at some points, or, you know, just like with the BMI thing, man, the Air Force made a bad decision. We can totally stand up and do it. People get it messed up though, because then all they talk about is the negative stuff. You look at somebody's page or you look at somebody's interactions, and every single one is just completely, you know, willing to ignore the fact that, you know, for 22 years, the Air Force gave me a great life and a great time and the best friends that I've ever had and all that other stuff. So, man, I agree with you. Let's focus on the positives. Take me back to a young Trenton Segmuller that's getting ready to get in. What did you love about it? What got you into the Air Force, and why were you so enamored with being a SOW-T when you started?
Well, the thing is I didn't know it existed for the longest time. You know, like, and here's one of the great things about, I think, what happened, you know, to me or my story is I didn't know anything about it, you know? And I remember sitting in weather tech school, looking out our windows, yes, we're sipping our coffee or drinks or whatever. I was, I think, pre-Monster. So there you go with the dates, kids. And I saw the combat control trainees run by with a log, right? Uh-huh. Or rocks or whatever. And we'd be like, man, that is awful. You know, like, all the folks around me are like, that is the worst thing I've ever seen.
That's the worst. I'm going to pass on that. Look at that. Look how tired they all look. Why are they all sweaty all the time?
Yeah. And mostly I was like, well, the short shorts, I'm not getting behind just yet. But there was a part of me that was like, man, like, what am I doing here? Like, those guys are out there crushing. And I'm sitting in here just doing my job. And I think that's what planted the seed. So when the guys came and gave the briefing, it was just like, yes, like, I don't know what it was. And that's the cool thing about the military, is if you're willing to put yourself out there and try and assess, you know, for whatever it is, whether it's, you know, well, you want to be a dog handler in security forces or any of these other things, you're going to get these opportunities. So that's kind of how it all started. And honestly, I think going into it blind was awesome, because I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I had no expectations. And so, yeah, I just kind of, hey, what do I got to do? And they're like, here's the roadmap. I'm like, okay, I'll do exactly what you tell me to do to get that funny hat and to do the things that they told me in the briefing. You know, like, I want to be closer to the action. I want to do more. I don't want to just sit behind a desk and give out weather forecasts. No offense to those folks, but it wasn't my thing. And so, yeah, and then, yeah, you know this, once you start on that journey, the things you learn about yourself, and I know that sounds hokey, right? Oh, I started off my journey and I started to learn about myself through pain and suffering and discipline. Right. But that's just the truth, you know? Like, you start working out and, you know, like, I remember I told everybody like that in my chain, I'm going to be a Saudi. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, I didn't think I needed to remind them every 10 minutes what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Because in the middle of my shift, 12-hour shift every night, I'm going out for a run and I'm doing cows. I'm working on the stuff that I need to work on so I can do this thing. And I remember it was like a few months before I crossed over, some master sergeant was like, well, is he even still doing that? Are you still going to do that? And I was like, I don't understand. Like, yeah.
You know, it takes a little bit for this to work out.
Yeah, right, it's pretty well. But like, that's another thing that told me, like, there were folks that when they showed up, they were like, yeah, I'm going to be a Saudi. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. And then like most of them just kind of like fell away into the greater weather community. What about you? What got you started?
A love of America. If we're talking about love letters, you know what I mean? Like, I grew up as a very patriotic dude, and then September 11th happened and I was like, man, this is it, you know? And you know, that's not necessary. I say that all the time, and I cringe sometimes when I hear myself say it, because again, it sounds like the hokiest thing. Like, I really did get into the military to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's really, really what I wanted to do. And then I found pararescue, and it was one of those things where I didn't know why I wanted to do pararescue. I had no clue. And I literally had to figure that out. And for me, it took 5 years and 4 indoc teams and a lot of trials and tribulations. And your story about the master sergeant, the last trip that I went on as a phys tech. So my other job, for those of you that are new to the team room, what's up? I had another job. I was a cross trainee for 5 years. So I cross trained back into pararescue in 2006 is when I graduated in doc. Maybe early 2007 or something. 2006 is when I went the first time.
You got hit in the head a lot after that. I did. So yeah. It's hard to say.
The explosions, the TBIs and stuff, it makes my timeline a little bit wonky. Like, you know, and the Dark Knight was like, oh, you never start at the head. It makes him all woozy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. That's essentially me at 24 hours a day. So, you know, coming into 2001 and, you know, then, you know, failing in doc in 2002 and then coming back 2005 or 2006. You know, I learned a lot about a whole bunch of stuff, but there was a long period in there where I was like, man, I was, you know, leaning into this other job and trying to be successful at that. And luckily I had, you know, we're going to have Major Anthony Cosentino. He was part of that little group that I used to work with as a phys tech. There's 3 or 4 dudes out there that I really do credit with helping me get back to becoming a PJ. These guys woke up with me every morning. They were doing bodybuilding shows and stuff. And Kaz is still in amazing shape. That guy is just jacked, first team all body. And you'll see when he comes on, but I really do credit that support system. They would wake up with me at 4 o'clock in the morning. They would take turns going for runs with me because they weren't training to go to indoc. They were just training. Man, they would take turns working out with me. Like every morning when I showed up at that gym at Andrews Air Force Base at 4:45, I was guaranteed to see, we called it the breakfast club. I was guaranteed to see like one of like 5 dudes, and they would not let me slack. It was one of those things where they were like, hey man, I would miss like one day. I'd take like a program rest day. I wouldn't like work out on Tuesday. I'd show up to work and I have 3 dudes look at me and be like, oh yeah, tight. Not going to be a PJ from the couch, bud. And I was like, bro, it's a rest day. Give me a second. But you do learn a lot about yourself. And then it does become really addicting. It really does become a part of you to where now it's ingrained after 22 years. One of the best things that the Air Force really did instill discipline. It really did instill perseverance. It really did teach me how it is that I need to prioritize myself when I was a young man that his brain wasn't even fully formed. You know, I got in at 22. I was a functional idiot. I was an immature young kid. I wasn't much better when I was 25. I wasn't much better when I was 30, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, I definitely do remember that time I was on my very last trip as a phys tech. So we're out there and it was Yuma, Arizona, and I was the team leader, but there was a master sergeant that was there and he was working. There were 2 planes that were working. We were breaking one of the planes down after a day of testing. And he looks at me and he goes like, hey man, we got another trips coming up in October. Do you want to do that? Cause I like the dynamic here. He's like, I'd like to by name request you come out. And I'm like, well, hey man, I'm going to indoc. You know, I'm supposed to show up in like September. I think that's the deal. Like I got to, you know, whatever. So I won't be here. You know, I'll be at indoc. And he's like, well, you're going to quit pretty much right away. So yeah,
really, you think you'll still be at indoc?
said it to my face. Was like, well, no, you're going to quit. So I'm going to put you on the trip. And then this month, dude, I got home and there was like, you'd get a, like an automated alert. Like when somebody puts you into like the planning process of like, hey, welcome to this functional thing where we're going to like you input all your stuff. And it was a computer program that we used. I got an email like a week later. He signed me up for the trip. I was like this is when I graduated the pipeline. I will say I took a picture of myself in my beret. I got my official photo in my beret. I autographed it And I said, go F yourself. And I sent it to him because I'm petty. and that's who I am. But that's kind of how
I would have framed it. I would have been like, this dude, like, good, you know, like, because like he knew the percentages. He's yeah. probably known people that went there before. He's like, yeah, you're not going to make it. And when you made it, he's probably like, cool.
Go figure. Yeah, but I'll tell you what, like the love affair with pararescue, or really the love affair with the Air Force writ large, kind of started then. Like it was, you know, hearing all these stories, I guess I never put it into perspective, but hearing stories from folks that have chain of commands that aren't supportive, or people that are trying to keep them down or whatever, man, I had the exact opposite of that. You know, I had a support system. I had a whole squadron that was basically rooting for me. The second I graduated INDOC, people were like, holy crap, as far as we're concerned, you're a PJ. You know, you got to work out and you got to try to get yep. through the pipeline. And I would go to, you know, dive school and free fall and some other stuff. It was funny being a phys tech with a, you know, free fall and a dive bubble and stuff like that, because I was still teaching until I PCS. But yeah, man, I don't know if I would have been able to make it without that support system, without those dudes that supported me and made it there. But it was, yep. it was one of those things, like that continued the entire pipeline. Like that was just the start of feeling what it was like to really be on a team and really have people give a shit about you and your success. Like, we really care about our teammates' success in here. When somebody wins an award in Air Force Special Warfare, the person that lost to the guy that won doesn't go, oh crap, you know, that guy's terrible, he didn't deserve. They go, holy shit, man, good job, man, I'm so proud of you. Yeah. That is amazing. I can't believe you were able to do those things. And there's a million examples.
When I get promoted, I feel wicked guilty, because all I can think about is the guys that didn't get promoted, that I'm like, they're way better than me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. on the people that helped you in, you know, when you watch like a race, like a track race or something, and they have like that rabbit person that goes out there and paces them for like the first couple laps.
Right.
That's what I think it was. Cause those, you know, those people didn't end up where we're at. Like, I had a workout buddy who ended up getting out and doing other things in life, and he's awesome. And he was in way better shape than I was, you know? And he was psychotic, but like, yeah, same thing. Like, made me work out, you know, like taught me a whole bunch of stuff about working out that I didn't understand because I was an idiot. And then I went off to go be a SOT, and he just, you know, got out of the Air Force. But like, he paced me through that, the first couple of years of my career, to make sure that I was on track, that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing to be successful. And he didn't even come with me. He's just like, oh,
right.
Good luck, bro.
Right.
You know, and we still talk to this day, and he's a fantastic human and probably still in better shape than I am, like forever.
Hilarious.
A crazy
it's
person.
Like the meme of you know, the Avengers, you know, I guard a treasure which I cannot you know, hold myself. Like, he basically got you there. What was your favorite part about the first, kind of like that first, call it like two, three years, like in the pipeline? So not necessarily in the pipeline, but first couple of years of you in the job, like what did you love about that?
Yeah, so for anybody that's not tracking, I did not go through like a formal training pipeline. You know, and
my favorite
that's going to bring up a lot of, please leave the comments about how you think you're better than me because you went through a pipeline. I also agree with you that you're better than me because you went through INDOC and I did not. But it's super interesting. Yeah. So like, all we had to do was go through Airborne and SEER, which was, it's, you know, like, you know how in our community, Airborne and SEER are like, if you fail out of that, it's, everybody's confused. It doesn't make any sense how you could fail Airborne or SEER. But I went to SEER with another dude that just couldn't do the water portion, you know, like water survival or whatever, where they put you in the little chairs and they flip you over with the Heeds bottle and
yeah, the dunker.
The dunker and all that.
Sure.
But like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, to like the normal populace, like, you come back and it's like, yeah, I passed. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. Like, they told me right. to do stuff and I did it. And the other dude who didn't pass, it was just like, it's like one of those things along the way where like, it wasn't a formal pipeline, but like, people that wanted or said that they wanted to do it, they fell off. Because they didn't spend any time in the water training. Like, all you have to do is spend like a minimal amount of time in the water to get through the dunker. Like, it's not rocket surgery.
It's really not. Yeah. The dunker is like a crazy thing. It was like, yeah, it was a training thing that you needed before you could go through like parts of the pipeline for us. Like, you need, if you're going to fly in a helicopter, you have to go through the water survival training. That's what it's for, right? The helicopter dunker, for those of you that aren't tracking, it is literally a big hole of like a helicopter, right? So it does sort of look like a helicopter, the fuselage part of it, but not the tail and not the nose and blah, blah, blah. It's got a bunch of seats in it. They can dunk it and then flip it upside down. And you're supposed to get out of it. The SEER guys run it. It's up in Spokane. It's cool. right? It's like a cool bit of training. For the PJ, it was hilarious too, because like you see every single like PJ combat controller, somebody that's like post dive school, you know, you see them and you hit the water, they turn it upside down, and you can tell exactly who's been through, you know, water survival training or any sort of water confidence training, because you just sit there. You just wait. Everybody else is like panicking. You're just like slowly like, okay, let me grab a reference point. Let me get this seatbelt off. Okay, cool. These people are like thrashing about. I'm going to wait for them to get out of the way. And then, you know, they get out of the way. There was a, one of the things that I love is the traditions, right? So my favorite parts of the pipeline are the traditions and the shenanigans, man, because there's a lot of traditions and there's a lot of shenanigans. Everything from, you know, slapping that sign saying "Hoo Yah never quit" when you leave the in-dock building, to not stepping on the green feet, to saying "Hoo Yah green feet" or "Hoo Yah lightning bolt" when you're walking around it, you know, carrying the log, singing Jody's, all these things are, man, such good memories of all of these things, you know, with your bet. And it sounds dumb. Like, so you mean to tell me that one of the, you know, best memories that you have is running around with your friends in short shorts, Lackland Air Force Base, nobody has any shirts on. It's a 10-mile run. You're running with a huge rope that has brass on the end of it for whatever reason. And you're just singing and people are like shocked. They're like watching you go by. They're just like, oh my God, who are they? Just in the best shape of your life, super casually running a 7-minute pace, singing as loud as you can. Like, that's a ridiculous thing to try to explain to somebody. But man, that graduation run from Indoc, that's a big deal, baby. That was awesome. I distinctly remember that run and just being like, holy shit, we made it. We freaking did it. Like, I loved the shenanigans and all the other stuff that we did. But one of the shenanigans that I don't know why it is that we started this, but everybody that came back to Kirtland would be like, hey, if you go to the dunker training on your way out, as you're like leaving the dunker, try to take the regulator out of the SEER guy's mouth, because SEER guys would get dive qualified. SEER guys would be safety divers. Hold on. Anytime that I say the word, the survival evasion resistance and escape word, my computer thinks that the automated lady that you use on your iPhone is, oh, I'm talking to her. So then it screws everything up. Anyway, I don't know why it started. Like, those dudes would get dive qualified so they could be safety swimmers, but they didn't go to like combat dive school, right? But they would tell you that they were dive qualified. And it became this point of contention, because they would kind of like try to like haze you and be an instructor. And you'd be like, hey, bro, you're a fat, out of shape, survival guy that just
like
happens
a patty cert, you know. Yeah, like, you, that's
what you around, you're a salvage guy, I don't care, whatever. But there became this tradition where they'd be like, hey, on your way out, knock the regulator out of his mouth. Nice. Like, why? Well, just to screw them. That's why. Like,
just to alpha them a little bit.
I will say there's one student, I won't say his name because he's still active duty, not only did he knock the regulator out of his mouth on his second go, but he had to go on a second time because this guy was doing something and he was breathing off of his emergency regulator. This SEER guy turned around and there's just this little PJ kid. He's like, because he was already dive qualified. So he's just sitting there. And he's
what's
just
up, looking bro?
At him. He just snuck up behind him and he stole his binoculars. He just ugly. He's like, and because he was doing something with another student, he wasn't paying attention to the senior, and it, like, so they failed him. They were like, you didn't do it. He had to do it over again, and then he swept the regular out of the guy's mouth. It became this big deal. It was pretty funny. It was hilarious. But those sort of things, man.
I found a regulator. So
I guess you should have this clip to you. If it's out there, don't expect me not to breathe on it. You didn't tell me I couldn't. So but those pipeline stories and those shenanigans, man, like, that's some of the best. Like, do you know how hard we laughed when that guy told that story? There used to be something at Kirtland called the COC. It was the Cone Operations Center. So if you were in between, the COC. So if you were in between courses or whatever, like, the students would, you know, you had whatever officer, whatever NCO was ranking, and basically, you know, you reported into the MTLs. And, you know, they would give you details for the day. It was really loose. Like, you were supposed to go like work out. So dudes would just work out 2 or 3 times a day and basically scurve and try to not get hit with details. Do you know how hard we all laughed when we heard that story? We're like, wait a second. So you failed. They made you do it again because you stole the dude's regulator and then you swept it from his mouth. Laugh like an idiot. But those are the things that you remember. Like, of course, everything is stupid. Like, but I don't remember going on one stupid detail. I remember laughing with my friends, getting out of work and scurving and going to the gym and like literally like running away from an area giggling because instructors were coming and we didn't want to be there. You know what I mean? Like just nonsense.
It's always the good time. I remember, at the Dunker, I remember they were like, hey, can I get the PJs? Cause they're like, it's like 15 meters wide and you have to do like an underwater to start. It's like super short. And I just remember, you know, watching the PJ students drop into the water, not kick off the wall, and just go to the bottom of the pool and casually do their underwater and pop up and like kind of look at everybody like, we're better than you. You know, like, but that's how you take it. Like, it's not a thing.
Right.
But I remember at certain points going through like my non-formalized training, I would see PJ candidates when I was at Keesler doing the observing course for weather. I remember going to the natatorium and like the stow candidates would show up in the afternoons because they'd get out of class early. And just looking at those guys and seeing what they were doing, I'm like, oh, that's the standard that I need to be going towards, not whatever these other people think is hard. Like, this is where I need to be going. So, I mean, there's a lot of cool moments through all that. And then it's kind of weird because like my training and my deployment history is kind of mixed up because I went through like a little bit of training when I first got to the unit, you know, in the cherry ceremony. And I do want to talk about that because, like, we used to do like the old army traditions with the cherry helmet and all that other stuff.
Heck yeah, that's a lot. And, I'll tell you what, there's a one of the great traditions, one of the great pieces of culture at the 2-2. I'll tell you for sure when you show up to some of those the strike troops used to do it. We had the different troops, and now it's Alpha Flight and Bravo Flight. But before, when you came to a strike troop, man, dudes walked around. They had a flag. Like dudes would walk around with a cherry helmet on. There's a Viking horn. one of the teams every morning. It was like you're getting ready, and it was just 100%. It was normal ops. You would just hear, woo, and it was like the start of the day. And it was like the new guy had to blow the Viking horn. Absolutely hilarious. Like, it was just, it was one of those things. It was like 9:15. Hey, everybody, 9:15, have a great day. Woo, hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And these are grown men that fucking kill people, right? Yeah. Like, the team sergeant that's making that young guy do it, the young guy doesn't necessarily understand. The team sergeant's like, hey, man, this is how we do it in our culture. And oh, by the way, we're going to allow you to drop bombs on people and take human life at will as a young man. But anyway, go blow this Viking horn and tell everybody it's time to start the workday.
Yeah, like, how do you explain that to people? It's like, what did you do today? What's it like at the new unit? Like, you're talking to your old friends like, well, I tried to avoid everybody with my cherry helmet because if I lose it, then I have to do like 8,000 extra push-ups before I can go on my first jump. And at some point, like, I was being dragged, literally dragged around the unit. Like, I can see, like, the skid marks from my boots all the way around, you know, all the office space and everything else as they tried to rip this thing out of my hands.
Yep.
And they're like, wait, what? You're like, yeah, I'm the new guy. So, and then after we finished that, I took out the trash. They told me I was stupid. I went home, passed out, showed up the next day for PT.
Yeah. And guess what? That group of people, if anybody else from any other organization walked in the building and tried to tell you, the new guy, oh, hey, what's up, new guy, you piece of shit. Everybody that was just hazing you would beat the crap out of the guy that would come in there, because that's what the team is. Like, everybody pays those dues. And we make the joke about hazing or bullying or whatever else. Bro, make hazing great again. Man, bring back bullying. Bring back that. That's, you're literally being indoctrinated. It's why we called it the indoctrination course. You're being indoctrinated into our culture. You're being indoctrinated into our career fields. That indoctrination doesn't stop. When you get to your first unit, you're the new guy. Man, there is something, and it took me a long time to figure it out because I've never yarded in, right? So yarding in and yarding out is another tradition that we have. And typically, with the rescue units and some of the ST units, it could be a yard, it could be a boot. Typically, you're supposed to do it with an alcoholic beverage, right? Like, and you do it on, when you get to the unit, you know, you yard into the unit and then you yard out to the unit. Usually there's a time attached to it, right? There's a bunch of different rules. It's a tradition. I don't condone binge drinking, right? Because I think it's like 8 beers goes into a yard of beer or something. Jeez. So, you know, you got guys that are just housing a yard of beer, and typically it's like, it's a good time. The team's there, and as long as you take to finish it, that's as long as you take to finish it. It's a pretty cool, you know, whatever. But, you know, when I looked at those things, like, as I look back at it now as an old man, as a guy that's now, you know, becoming more irrelevant day by day, I look back and I'm like, man, I got to do the same thing. They hazed me the same way that they hazed Chief Master Sergeant Wayne Fisk. Yep. They hazed me the same way they hazed Cunningham, Mike Maltz, you know, these guys that are giants. Like, I got to do the same thing that they did. That is, and then I get to wear this little hat. Everybody that sees this little freaking target that you wear on your head, man, they wore this hat too. People brought me in, good, bad, or indifferent. Something that I absolutely loved is that those traditions are there because that's how you form a new teammate. That's how you bring them into your culture, get them to value the same things that you value. And looking back on it, man, bring back hazing, bring back bullying, like reject modernity, embrace tradition, essentially, because it's so good. Like looking back on it now, I feel bad for people that don't get hazed. I feel bad for people that don't have to blow a Viking horn to start their work day off. Like, take pride in that. It is awesome. Like your little cherry helmet when you go off on your first jump. Hell yeah, man. And if you see that red cherry helmet, if that red cherry helmet hits the dip and he beats other jumpers, better forget about it. Better give that man his due. Better give that man his flowers.
Dude, well, that's pretty hard because I know on my cherry blast, the amount of equipment I had on me weighed more than I did.
Yeah, it was 100%.
It was pretty
rough.
It's
never easy. Yeah. I didn't say hazing was going to be comfortable. I just said it was valuable.
Yeah, but it brings like a certain humility to you as well. And I think the reason I remember the first time any, you know, the older guys said I did something well after that.
Holy shit, it made it
that much more important to me, right? Like, oh, dude, yeah, like you're in pretty good shape or you did this pretty well or anything, like, because you're chasing that. Like the first couple of years is like, I just want to be part of what you guys are.
Right.
And then you figure it out. And then, you know, new guys show up and you're just like, man, I want you to have the same great experience where you're humbled and then you chase it. And then once you get there and you're one of our teammates, like it's a feeling that's difficult to describe, you know,
right.
Going through like the different types of training, and you don't want to be like dramatic about it and be like, oh, my life is literally in their hands and we're shooting live rounds around each other and all these other things. But like, that's the reality of the situation.
That is what's happening. Like, yeah. I'll tell you straight up. Those are hard lessons to learn. I distinctly remember CA, my team sergeant, you know, speaking about like, you want that validation. You want to hear, you know, your team, we called him dad. Everybody always called him dad. It was either dad or boss. Like we called him. I mean, this guy is a absolute stud. He was one of the last PJs that flew left seat. So for, you know, history's sake, pararescuemen are air crew gunners and scanners as well. It's part of our mission statement, right? So it basically went, PJs were doing everything in the back of the aircraft to include gunning, scanning, being an air crew member. They were part of the crew, right? And then they were also doing survival stuff. This is way back in the air rescue service days, right? Air rescue and recovery service days, ARRS, before pararescue was a thing, 1966. But basically we're like, hey man, if we're going to go off the aircraft and go rescue these people, we can't be gunners and scanners anymore. We got to hand the survival job over. So you're welcome, survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. I gave birth to you. Y'all's my sons. Moving on. I remember the first time like that guy taught me that history, and he was part of that history. He was one of the last guys at the weapons school to fly in the left seat. He was one of the last guys to do those things. He spent his career chasing war criminals around Europe. You know what I mean? That's who I grew up under. We were going out. It was like one of my first for real training trips. We actually came out here to Vegas to do a whole bunch of flying. And, you know, this is another thing I love is the friends you make along the way, even if you lose them. And one of those guys was Wisniewski. So we lost Wisniewski and that crew to include, you know, Joel Gentz, Ben White and Flo and Mike Flores and Pedro 6-6. Well, I actually did my entire helicopter 5-level element leader upgrade with the crew that went down, with Dave Smith, with Wiz, with Simone, with Aggie, with all those folks, right? Out here in Vegas. I distinctly remember, man, my team sergeant, I was a young PJ. I was primary medic. I was doing a simulated medical exercise in the back, and all of a sudden something happened and it felt like somebody punched me underneath my, like in the spot where I didn't have plates, right? Cause I was wearing my body armor, but right underneath, I was doing something. I was like, oh God. And I turned around and I looked and in fact, my team sergeant had punched me because he's like, hey, you unplugged my comm cord for the third time, quit it. And then he just slapped the crap out of my helmet. And I was just like, he was just old school like that. Like you'd be working underneath the helicopter, the same training event. I'm trying to get a litter, you know, get a patient underneath a litter. There's a hoist. He's holding the hoist and whatever else. And again, I just get this smack. And I thought something dropped out of the helicopter. And I look up and I was incorrectly placed under the helicopter. When you're doing this, the helicopter is supposed to remain in a hover, but it's really hard to remain in a hover. So sometimes the helicopter moves. Well, you don't want to be on the opposite side of the hoist. Right. So if the helicopter is this way, if the patient's here and I'm fixing things here, right? If the helicopter's here, the hoist is on the right side of the helicopter. If we're going this way, you don't want to be over here. because it undulates and whatever. You constantly have to check up, see where the helicopter is, look up, see where the helicopter is, and like get your patient. I had no idea what I was just in the fight, dude. I was like, man, I hope this litter works, yeah. Right? It just flaps. All that to say, I remember the first time that CA looked at me and was like, hey, Aaron, that was a pretty good run for you. Hey, that was a pretty good job. And you were like, holy fuck, I made it. This is it. This is what I'm meant to do.
Yep. Yeah, those moments are crazy. And they shape who you are, right? I remember being out at Fort Campbell doing a training event where, you know, they had two of us newer guys and they messed with our rifles and we had to go away and look the other direction. You run up to your rifle, you have to put it back together and you have to ops check it and you have to hit the target, right?
Sure.
And, you know, you win one of those competitions and it's silly. Like, why do I still remember that?
Yeah.
Because, like, I hit the target first and they were like, man, nice. And it's just right. Like, because I wasn't the first guy to get a shot off, but I was the first guy to hit the target. You know, right. Like those are the things that you remember that are like, yeah, getting the first shot off is less important than hitting the target.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, okay. And that kind of shapes the whole rest of your career, you know, and then it gives you stuff to keep working towards. I remember at AST, you know, SAOT was always weird, right? It was, we were like the redheaded stepchildren. We didn't go through the pipeline. And at the end of that pipeline, when, the LT over the team, we did a monster mash at the end and he put me on like the A team, you know, like nice. I was a gray hat on the A team. And I know right. It sounds silly, but to me, you know, we won that monster mash and all these other things. It was like, man, like I think I'm part of this team. And this is after my first deployment. Like I'd been in combat and that was still a big deal to me to be like, you know, taken in by the community and, you know, and someone being like, yes, you belong here. We accept you. And then everything that happens after that. And when you're talking about the litter thing, I remember, dude, like in the beginning, there's so much stuff that you have to like keep at the forefront of your brain that if you're not used to it, it's so overwhelming. And then like 3 years later, when you're watching someone try to do it, it's like, he's not paying attention to the helo.
Not being right.
Yeah,
exactly.
What is this idiot doing?
it's so apparent to you. And then like, yeah, it's a funny thing too. It's like you totally forget that you were ever that bad. Like that's why one of my favorite parts about being an instructor, right, is like, you know, you'd have to, I love hearing new instructors rant, be like, oh, these effing students and whatever else. I'd be like, hey, bro, remember when you were a student? I went through the pipeline with you. Remember when you couldn't for the life of you figure out how to tie a figure eight and we got smoked all day of it because you couldn't tie a single knot? Like let's manage our expectations for how good these students are supposed to be. And then let's temper that with how good you were as a student, as opposed to how good you think you were, because you weren't that good. Nobody was. You were a student.
Dude, I remember former students of mine as instructors and me going out there to like, you know, do some stand eval stuff in AATC. And yeah, you hear them talk and you're just like, bro, like, no. Like I was there. They're like, this is what it was like when I came through. I'm like, that's not.
No, it was not
at all what it was.
No, I was there. Right. Yeah. No. I went through that. I went through that with you. You did not do that.
I was present, but
yeah. Yeah. My first save, and you know, since we're, you know, love letter to whatever, and you kind of, you reminded me of it when you were like, hey man, you got the nod to be on the Monster Mash team. You went there, man. The very first mission that I ever did, you know, we were doing a confined space, event down in Bristol. It was down in Bristol, England. So we were on this ship. It was actually really, really cool. There was one of your brethren, Eli is his first name. I will leave it at that. It was his birthday. Like another great tradition, another great part of our culture is that, you don't let anybody know when it's your birthday because you're going to get the crap beat out of you. Like when they figure out that it's your birthday, you are getting tied to a, spine board. You are going to be forced to drink alcohol, probably way too much alcohol. And if you're JMAC, you're going to hold somebody down and slap them on the stomach with a fin until their belly is nice and pink.
Yeah. Your social security number when you're on team is like out there. Like it's not secret. Like people are like, oh, don't give away your social. No. That's everywhere. No.
I had
but
a
your
sheet.
Birthday.
Bro, I had a single sheet on the drive that had every single piece of information of every single team member on my flight. I had 25 people on a flight. You know, generally I had my one God sheet because the last thing that I'm doing when I'm writing EPRs or when I'm writing award packages or EPBs now, whatever, or when I'm doing all these admin things is to bother you at home to get a piece of information that I should have. So when you got to my teams, I'm like, fill everything out. name, birthday, government travel card number. I need your expiration date. I need your social. I need your wife's name. I need a number that I can call you all the time. I need a good civilian email for you. I need your official photo. I'm like, listen, I know it's intrusive, but I need all of this stuff to include your birthday. And then I would put every single birthday inside of my phone. And one of my favorite things to do is when I wake up and I look at my little calendar, and I do it to this day, by the way, I still have friends that I will call on their birthday. Just be like, happy birthday, bro. And they're like, how do you even have my number? I'm like, because for years, I would look at that stupid sheet and I'd be like, oh, this guy's birthday is on April 19th. Here we go. Reminder every year. And then I just love sending that little text message out. And I like doing it. My favorite time to do it would be in the team room. And I would walk out and I'd be like, oh, hey, everybody, Josh, happy birthday, man. And then I would just turn right back around and I would walk, because then everybody would be like,
sharks.
Oh, dude. There's
chum in the water.
Blood in the water. Josh is about to get tuned up. But there we were in Bristol. It happened to be Eli's birthday. We were like, hey, we need a patient for this. You're a weather guy, so of course you're going to be the patient. So we start getting him in there, and then we put his hands on. Usually, like if you're a real world patient, like you're secured. You can't really move. You can't grab stuff. Cause if you try to grab me when I'm hoisting you or doing something, stuff, it's bad. You shouldn't do that. Right.
Wait, that would be bad.
Right. But when it's an operator pretending to be a patient, usually we let you have your hands and whatever else. Well, we start tying his hands down. And just as we get his second hand security, he goes, hey guys, why are you guys? What? And we look and he goes, oh, fuck you guys. And we just like, yep. So we had him completely tied down. We hung him over. This is a big Navy ship, a big English Navy ship. We hung him over the side and we basically dunked him in the water, like from the ship, and people from the side, and we're singing happy birthday to him. It was hilarious. And we, no kidding, that day got the call that there was a sick sailor, like 400 miles off the coast of Ireland in the North Sea. Right. So like way out there. So, and J-Mac was actually the team leader for this one, by the way. J-Mac was on the jump team. Well, the team leader looked at me from up the street. We didn't have enough PJs to go around at the STS. So one of the PJs from Lakenheath, his name was D-10. I take it back. That was Schwartz, was the team leader's name. He's since retired. So Schwartz looked at me and he goes, hey, man, I'm going to take you with me on the helos. These guys think that they're going to jump. I don't think that they're going to jump to the boat. I think they're going to hoist us down and I want you to be the primary medic. And I was like, oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. Like, I'd been a PJ for like 6 months. We were training. We're having a good time. But I had never been put in a position where I was like, okay, well, you really got to do the job. And then that changed within 18 hours. Like, we left that place. We drove up and we launched. I mean, you know, 12 hours later from call to there. Whole bunch of refueling. It was a wacky scenario. And I found myself being hoisted down to the ship to get this guy with appendicitis, you know, a super tanker in the middle of nowhere. And it was socked in. It was like 100-foot. Clouds and stuff.
Yeah.
We're just balling out, just figuring out how to do. I get hoisted down to a super tanker. I, you know, make my assessment of the guy. We get ready, we hoist up, and then I take care of him all the way back to Ireland. And, you know, the smoke kind of cleared. He was like, yeah, perfect, man. I knew that, you know, the C-130 team probably wasn't going to be able to jump and then recover to the larger ship. So I had a good feeling that we were going to go in and you did a good job. And I was like, holy shit, what am I even doing? Yeah. You know, like, There was a brief moment where I felt good. There was a brief moment. And I think we got, I believe the Sikorsky, that was the Sikorsky rescue of that year. It was the 2010s rescue of the year for the helicopter. The helicopters give awards and stuff like out for that. But I was just shocked. I was like, holy effing crap. This is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So when you're called to do it for the first time, it's crazy. I remember even before I even went to AST, right? I did my first rotation and it's terrifying when they're like, hey, you got to go now. And it's like, why do I got to go? They're like, well, our other guy got shot. You're like, yeah. Wait, what? You're like, the reality of the situation just like comes all at once.
Wait, know? This sounds dangerous.
Yeah. There's nobody else. They're like, there's nobody else. And there's technically, per this paper, you're trained enough to go there. And you probably aren't going to do anything, right? When you get in country, right. You sit at CAF for a few minutes or, you know, I was there for a while. And then they're like, oh, you're going forward. I'm like, me?
What do you mean? You know, like, what do you mean forward?
Yeah, like you're going to this the FOB, and then like other Green Berets that are around are like, bro, keep your head down. You're like, why is this happening? Like, I'm new.
Why is everybody so worried about me? Good. Good. Why?
Yeah.
You're like, guys are like giving you, hey man, I got an extra ice cream cookie for you today. And you're like, why? Why? Hey Trent, what are you planning on doing with that Xbox?
Yeah.
I mean, if anything happens, can I just have it? What?
We actually did have my buddy and I, he because the second Sauti showed up, so we went to the BX right there, right across from Brown, and we bought one of those big tube TVs. You know, it's probably like 32 inches, oh, which sure. was huge at the time. And we put it, we
700 pounds.
Yeah.
You need a forklift. It had an actual tube. You could hear it when it turned on. It's like,
yeah.
Had the static yeah. shit.
Yeah. The FBI guys that were there in country, which is weird that the FBI was in country. But anyway, they'd left and they had like this 2-story room in the compound. And we took over that 2-story room. That TV was there for like 12, 15 years, whatever it was, right. forever. Like guys would be like, dude, I stayed in this room and there's a second floor and there's a giant TV up there with an Xbox. It's like, yeah, you're welcome.
You're like, yeah. That's the gaming center. We built that.
But it's like you said, like you have training and you go out there and your training is like your 80-90% solution. But then the rest of it's just figuring it out, you know? And like I fell on my face a few times. Team sergeants yelled at me and then you get home and they're like, hey, you're the guy of the year. You're like, I wasn't even here the whole year. Guys, I just barely showed up. And they're like, cool. Now go off and finish your training. Right. And but it happens real quick, and you know you get some of those accolades, and it just makes you more nervous, and maybe not nervous, but like you're like, dude, now I have to keep performing, otherwise, mm-hmm. it's over. But it's hard to explain how awesome it is. You get up back from that first rotation, and then you go on another one, and you know, the people that were like your heroes, and they're still your heroes, but like you become a teammate, and becoming a teammate, I don't know how to explain it. It's the greatest thing in the world.
Right. Yeah, the when you start changing from, you know, because you're a student for so long, a pipeline in training, you know, whatever, imposter syndrome plays a part in this. Like, you really, there is a power dynamic that you agree to for so long. Like, your instructors are superheroes. You know, when you look at these guys at ANS and pre-dive and some of these instructors that are running ANS and these other programs, combat control school or pararescue apprentice course or whatever you have, man. Those people they've got multiple deployments, you know, decorated in some cases, you know, highly, and you're just like, holy crap. The second when you kind of make that move to colleague, to peer, to, yeah. you know, you're never going to have that experience the same as them at the same time as them, maybe later in your career. It's humbling. It's terrifying. But you feel like you made it, right? And then as you go through those deployments, it changes a little bit because then you start caring about other people. Then the dynamic changes to like, you're the team sergeant. You're the one yeah. that has to get people through the deployment. You're the one that has to step up and be that guy. Like I distinctly remember the first time that I was training a 3-level and he didn't keep his eyes on the helicopter. What do you think I did? Slapped his helmet, pointed at the helicopter, told him to keep his eyes on the helicopter, and then told him to go back to work. And it was one of those things like, holy crap, am I the team sergeant now? Like, but and it's different, but it's still the single most righteous thing that you can do in the military, not only to have this mission, but to be a leader in that mission, to actually train somebody. I had the distinct pleasure of getting a text message where one of my friends was like, hey, man, I did this thing. It's a highly specialized unit. I'd like to send you a team patch. I think you had a big part in me being here, but I'm finally on team, fully qualified, and I want to send you a patch. That has nothing to do with me and everything to do with him, you know, for him to make the selection, for him to make the training, for him to be accepted into that world. I had nothing to do with that. He seems to think I do, but that's one of those things that we can talk about schools or we can talk about money or we can talk about whatever. The Air Force and Air Force Special Warfare will give you things that you could have never possibly imagined. And that's one of them.
Dude, you know, sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's same. Like I was in North Carolina. At a dinner, right, with a bunch of dudes, and a bunch of them had been my students, and they're still like, "Hey, Sagnal Trent, like, what's up, man?" You know, they still like, and you can right. feel there's like a certain amount of deference, and I'm like, "You guys don't understand, like, you guys are like my heroes,
right?"
And, you're like, and you guys are still treating true. Me like I had something to do, like I was just there, guys. Like, and I did my best, and I'm proud of what I did, but like, you have far surpassed me. And then there was some other stuff that happened too, like where I remember the moment. When I knew I wasn't coming back to team, mm-hmm. and I knew it was okay, because
oh, nice.
I didn't feel like the next generation was so much better, and like I feel very personal about it, right? Because like I the first Sauti pipeline, like I was there, and then I had a hand in like the SR pipeline, but especially the Sauti pipeline. I remember leaving the 2-3, and our friend Spencer, you know, was on team with me, and it's like one of those moments where it's like I'm going back to AETC, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to be on team again, and I mm-hmm. wasn't. but it was okay because I saw the next generation of dudes and I'm like, they're better than we ever were. And that's, mm-hmm. and that's fantastic. We put all this work into it and now I can go off and do my own thing and, you know, train some more people and then, you know, do staff, you know, stupid stuff at some point. But like that feeling too is ridiculous.
Yeah. 100%. And it's one of those things again, where you can't necessarily explain it to some people. Obviously people engage with us a whole lot. People that have been out for a long time, people will ask us straight up, well, how can you even be optimistic? And it's because of what you just said, because I've seen the people that are coming through. I've seen the next generation. I talk to them every single day. I talk to people that are coming into this career field every single day on DMs, on, you know, via video, on phone calls. Like I talk to the candidate pool 100%. That's why I'm okay with where we're going, because I've actually seen it. We have the distinct privilege of engaging with these folks and seeing the product every time and being so close to the training enterprise. We're going to be okay. Like I love the career fields with all of the scars and all of the problems and all the stuff that we always worry about and everybody gets all upset over. Even with all of that stuff, we're still going to be okay. It's okay to be a little bit optimistic and a little bit idealistic when we talk about this stuff, because we see the people that are coming in. We know the caliber of the instructors that are putting them through. That's a thing that I always love in this tangent is at anybody that wants to talk crap. Hey, just remember that your friends, your brothers in arms, those experienced people, those are the people that are instructing down at A&S. When you're like, oh, A&S sucks. A&S, Indoc was better than A&S. Listen, we can have those conversations all day, right? Like, got it. That's why we're here. We're here to talk about training enterprise and stuff. But just remember, like when you say A&S sucks, you're talking about your friend's product. You're talking about good American heroes that are given 100% of their effort to make the best possible course, to get the best possible candidate in and train in the best possible way. Just always keep that in mind when you're talking crap about these organizations or about the people that are coming through, because to be honest with you, your friends are the ones that are producing them. Your community are the people that are doing the thing that you're talking about.
And it's they're better than we were, you know, like the guys, like there's nothing I like engaging with the candidates and like the folks going through the pipeline is so awesome. Because I like it when they bring up instructor stories. And I remember these instructors from when they were students or young mm-hmm. folks on team.
Yeah.
And just hearing their stories, like, man, he was super hard, but he was fair. And you know, like the everything that Sergeant Neely, who was on the podcast, you know, like he's just like one of those force of nature guys when he was an instructor. And I remember, you know, Neely came through the pipeline when I was an instructor. And it's just like, yeah, of course that next generation that came up under Neely is going to be a certain type of way just because of who he was. And I know like the instructors that pushed him and all that other stuff. So yeah, it's a good feeling to know that like we came in, we learned the history, and then the next generation did the same thing. Like they went through the crap and they learned the history and they're trying to make it better. And like, right. That's why there's always thrash, and the thrash is not necessarily negative. And then because the community is special, you know, like it's in the name, the community, they don't forget. They have long, you know, histories. We got funny hats to remind us the traditions that we're trying to uphold. And we do a pretty dang good job, I think.
You're right. I would agree with you. And it's one of those things where you're always going to go through transitions. Like as you and I, you know, officially, you know, hit the retirement button and then worked our way out. And, you know, now we're both out, you know, there's always going to be times where, you know, the second that you get out, like everybody grows their hair long and grows a long beard. And they're like, oh, F the establishment. I don't want to be part of this anymore. I felt that way for, you know, a little bit. It's getting a little bit better now as we go through, you know, the transition phase. But overwhelmingly, and you know, to the point of this entire podcast, man, Air Force Special Warfare, for all of bad things, right? Like I've lost a lot of friends. I could easily, you know, go into a tangent here about, you know, the things that the career fields have taken away, because they will take from you. Like we tell everybody all the time, if you get in, the job is going to take 51% of your given life all the time. You can say you're a family man, you can say that you're a father, you can say you're a husband, you can say whatever you want. You are going to give 51% at a minimum time and attention to the United States Air Force and your given career field or your given profession. You just are. They're going to ask you to deploy. You know, sometimes that number goes up to 90% because you're deployed, you're away from your family, and you're in the fight. You can't be a good dad and go get into gunfights every night. You got to pick one, man. You got to turn on that savage part of your brain and you got to go be a gunfighter so that you can come back home to your family. So it's always going to be at least 51%. But I will tell you, the things that the career field has given me, the things that the Air Force has given me, far outweigh the bad stuff. Even after 22 years, even after the physical toll and the mental toll, and you know, that's a whole whiny story for some time in the future. But I'll tell you what, man, I still fucking love it. I still love saying that I was a PJ. I still love even the brothers that I disagree with and some people that I'd rather punch in the mouth than talk to. And of course, I am that person for a lot of people too. I'm completely aware of that.
No one's ever said that to me about you. That's...
You liar. Shut up. You said it to me before. I'll tell you what, man. Like, I just have nothing but gratitude and nothing but hope and nothing but love for those things that it's given me, all things considered. And I wish that I could put that into somebody's head. Because people ask us all the time, man, I'm very critical of a lot of things. I'm very critical of the government. I'm very critical of leadership. I'm very critical of the things that we're doing. I'm very attuned to the culture and the zeitgeist and the things that I think are good and that are bad. And I'm very vocal about it. I make no bones about that. But somebody will be like, well, how do you live in that space but still want to talk to people about getting into this thing that you seem to be very, you know, adversarial with? Like, don't take my adversarial nature incorrectly. I wish that I could put my brain about how I feel about the future of the career field, what it is that we need to do to make the career field strong going into the future, and still being able to find an idealist sort of nature, a positive, optimistic outlook, even with all the bad stuff. Because I honestly still do. I still care. I still want people to get in and be PJ. I've never told anybody, hey, man, maybe you shouldn't do this. The military right now is really stupid. There's a bunch of problems going on. You should wait. You should wait till we figure it out. I've never said that. You know why? Because I don't believe it.
Yeah. Well, like on like a sliding scale, right? Like I go after officers a fair bit, but like every bad quote unquote officer that I've ever worked with or around is like a -3. But right. Like your K-dubs and your buddies. K-dub
just texted me, by the way. I can't wait to release this. Like as we were sitting down, K-dub just texted me.
Yeah.
Asking me a question. It's funny that you mentioned him.
Well, and like, you know, yeah. John, the guy that did my retirement ceremony, all those other guys, like the they're like a +10. You know what I mean? Like right. That's how it is. Like the +10 is so much heavier than your -3. And right. That's how it, like, but like we're built to make things better. Like that's just who we are as a community. So like I might groan and all these other things, but yeah, I wanted to do this episode to remind not only y'all but myself about how awesome it is. You know, I almost get emotional thinking about like the 20-year career, and like you start thinking about your friends and all the things you got to do and how different of a person you are now from when you first got into the community. You know, it's a little overwhelming, but it was the best. You know, it was the best time. It was so much fun. And yeah. It's hard to explain it, right? Like, oh, like you were doing all these terrible things. Yeah, but it was awesome.
Right. Yeah. It was the worst time of my life, and I would go back and relive it again in a second.
Yep.
And I think that's the question. I think that's the bottom line for, you know, for this episode for me and really for how I feel about it. But I'll tell you what, all things considered, even knowing what I know now, if you looked at me and you're like, hey, with everything that you know now after 22 years, every single thing, that you had to go through, good, bad, indifferent, every single piece of it. We have a time machine. We could put you right back into it now, but you get to make the decision. Do you want to go and put yourself through all of those bad times again? I'd do it in a heartbeat. I'd do it right away. I'd go right back and I would go right back to NDOC, no matter how hard it was, no matter, you know, injuries and loss and, you know, ruined relationships and all this other stuff. Don't care. I would do it again in a heartbeat because I think it's that cool. And that is truly how much I love the career field and the endeavor that we've decided to take under. And I hope that people understand that.
Yeah. There's no replacement for that brotherhood. So I hope you all enjoyed this episode. I think that's a good place to end up because I'm going to come back snarky next time. I'm coming back, but I just wanted to hit a positive note.
Back to normal, Aaron and Trey. Yeah, we're going to go way up high, and then we're going to go ahead and just cut your legs out and take you right back down because listen up, cones and quitters. We love it. You haven't earned it yet, so you can love it as much as you want, but you need one of them silly hats first. So you better be out there training. Make sure you like, subscribe, share this stuff out there. Tell your friends, and you know, share it with somebody that doesn't even necessarily want to go into the Air Force Special Warfare. Maybe we can convince them. Maybe we can, with our love affair that we've had with this career, you know, 20 years later, maybe we'll convince them to maybe take that step too. That's the point. So thanks for everybody listening. We'll see you next time. Train hard.